Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features We Are Internationalists. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show, I'm Moisa Muntali. The music in the background is Uhuru Kwanza by Randy Weston. Today, Africa Now reflects on the work done in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and more broadly, the liberation movements in Southern Africa and other parts of Africa to explore the real meaning of solidarity. The conversation with Prexy Nesbitt and Martha Biondi also unpacks the historical continuities in contemporary issues. A lifelong organizer, Prexy Nesbitt was a key leader of the U.S. solidarity work with African liberation struggles from the 1960s through the 21st century. Nesbitt founded several pivotal international organizations, including the Mozambique Solidarity Network, the Chicago Committee for the Liberation of Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, the Chicago Coalition for Illinois Divestment from South Africa, and the Chicago Committee in Solidarity with Southern Africa. Nesbitt worked for Mayor Harold Washington, the World Council of Churches, civil unions, and taught for many years at Columbia College in Chicago. Martha Biondi is the Lauren H. Morton Professor of Black Studies and Professor of History at Northwestern University. A scholar of 20th century African American history, Biondi's teaching and research focus on social movements and black politics. Her book, The Black Revolution on Campus, tells the story of the black student movement of the late 1960s and the rise of black studies and affirmative action on college campuses across the country. She is the author of We Are Internationalists, Prexy Nesbitt and the Fight for African Liberation. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with Prexy Nesbitt and Martha Biondi.
I'd like to take the time to welcome you both, Martha and Prexy, for a very, very interesting and timely conversation on your recent book collaborative effort, We Are Internationalists, Prexy Nesbitt and the Fight for African Liberation. Thank you both for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you. Martha. Thank you, James. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And Prexy, of course, you're back for the second time on this particular program.
That's right.
So let's start here. Let's start at the ground floor of this particular conversation. Martha, why this project? How did this project start and come together, and why now?
The project began during the pandemic. I say ironically because that's when archives were physical, you know, archives were all entirely closed, you know, for a long time. And so, you know, I worried that I wouldn't be able to begin research on the book, but thankfully enough sources had been digitized that I was really able to do a lot of research during the pandemic. So I'm really grateful to librarians and archivists for that. But why, I think, is the bigger and more important question. You know, I think, you know, I've known Prexy for a long time. I've known him for over 25 years. We met through, you know, many mutual friends in Chicago, including some fellow historians. And so I was aware of, you know, before I started the research, I was aware of the anti-apartheid movement. I myself participated in as a college student, was even arrested at the consulate in New York City. So I was aware of the breadth and depth of this movement, its power internationally. But I knew that Prexy was also very involved in broader solidarity struggles, especially in Southern Africa, you know, with Mozambique, Namibia, Angola. So I was aware of his generation's impact on shaping U.S. foreign policy. And I thought that that was really an incredibly relevant and important lesson for today, when the U.S. is still, you know, has this hundreds and hundreds of military bases around the world, is waging wars in countries that Americans don't even know about, don't know where they are, and is, you know, when is the prime economic and military provider of aid to Israel, who's, you know, has been launching a genocide in Gaza. So it just struck me that the time was ripe for ordinary Americans to learn about a story of activists contending and fighting with their government's foreign policy and trying to prevent U.S. military intervention in the global south.
And that is obviously a very important, particularly if we're talking about, you know, obviously you mentioned Palestine, we can throw in Sudan, we could throw in, you know, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, so forth, Venezuela. You know, Prexy, from your perspective, in the context of this book, how do you see this moment and how do you see this book as kind of contributing to the discourses around global solidarity in this particular moment, based upon your historical and also contemporary contributions?
Thank you, James. I find myself feeling quite negative about the picture today. As we talk, we're hearing all about the shooting of these people in Venezuela in the waters, with a Secretary of Defense who just blew them off the boat, shot them to death. And what's particularly tragic to me in this moment is how little average Americans know about anything whatsoever, nor do they seem to care at all. I find that you can crack that lethargy and that ignorance, but it takes a lot of work to get beyond the barriers against knowing things about countries. For example, the average American had no idea that what's happened now is that large parts of African populations' children are no longer have any access to food supplies and relief supplies that have now been cut off by the Trump administration in terms of them being distributed by various organizations and mechanisms to African countries that have been in warfare or African countries that are singularly poor. It's really a great tragedy. And worst of all, the average American knows nothing about any of it and seems not to care.
Yeah. Mother, did you have a follow up? Because I was going to, and if you do have a follow up, please, by all means. But I also wanted to add to that your use of political biography, right? Your use of a mechanism to talk about historical continuities and contemporary issues, particularly around Palestine, using the anti-apartheid movement, fighting apartheid itself. You can respond to, obviously, Prexy, but then maybe couch it or kind of move into, you know, that use of political biography, because you, again, your work is extensive, but this is a very, you know, this tool is a very important tool for this generation to bridge, you know, historical consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. And I will just kind of echo, I think, some of Prexy's sort of despair at this political moment. I mean, you know, U.S. imperialism is ongoing in its efforts to sort of destabilize, you know, many nations, to control the flow of oil and other natural resources, and to gin up a kind of increasing, you know, geopolitical rivalry with China, is all very dismaying, as is its abolition of USAID, that for all its checkered past, you know, politically has been a major source of healthcare access and healthcare in many, many African nations. And now it's just gone and is having immediate lethal effects. So, this current administration has unleashed a new kind of tragedy upon the world. And we as Americans have to mobilize as much as we can to educate fellow Americans about what's happening and what we can do to stop it. So pivoting to your question about this sort of the genre I chose, like the approach, I really enjoyed doing a political biography because I got to, in some ways, Prexy's life trajectory as an organizer is so fascinating and so easily lends itself to, you know, to this kind of story, because he was Always committed to being part of a social movement and to building networks and to building dense webs of connections locally in Chicago and transnationally in Canada, Europe, Southern Africa, and elsewhere. So he seemed, you know, he was a person that you could tell his story, which was remarkable, but then make that part of a broader narrative about a broader social movement. So in some ways, the first chapter, which tells the story of his childhood and an extended family, which was, I think, crucial to understanding his political formation, that's the only traditional biographical chapter in the book. And then it proceeds, right, to focus on the social movement, again, with Prexy as a through line, because I think the choices he made and the work he did was so impactful and so pivotal through this long arc from the 60s through the, you know, through the 1990s. The book really ends with the fall of apartheid and the first elections in 94 and the aftermath. But Prexy's sort of organizing and educating life, you know, what has gone on and on ever since then. But the book really kind of goes from the 60s to the 90s.
Yeah, and I was going to, perfect segue into like talking about the chapters. Yes, chapter one outlines Prexy's early development, you know, engaging in that environment, which is also very important when we're talking about the intellectual development that is the fuel for one's praxis, particularly if we're talking about engaging in movement. And in this particular case, a global movement connecting continental Africans who are engaged in struggle, anti-colonialist movements, but also what's happening here in the context of the diaspora in the United States and also obviously in other particular places. So chapter one does that. Chapter two explores the ideological evolution in the U.S. African solidarity movement in the 1970s. I'm particularly going to come back to that. I'm very fascinated and particularly interested in those as someone who's also has one foot on campus, engaged in teaching, Africana studies, those type of things, but also someone who is very clear about developing, movement. How does movement inform what's happening in the classroom as well? So again, chapter two, we're going to come back to that. And then chapter three, of course, looks at, the breadth and depth of anti-apartheid. Prexy is a frame that widens the scope of the apartheid movement. And then, of course, Mozambique and the role of Prexy. And then chapter five, which is the chapter we're going to go back to, kind of end our conversation or pause our conversation, you know, what happened in that particular period? Because there's a dominant narrative of the anti-apartheid movement that basically kind of gives this kumbaya moment, like, you know, Nelson Mandela was released, but there was a lot of things happening and Prexy was involved and knew of those things, talking about, some may say the compromise of releasing Nelson Mandela in order to not face the armed wing of the particularities of the youth who are rising up, Black consciousness, so forth and so on. So those things become important as well. So Prexy, your connections and this political biography that Martha has kind of developed, you were very instrumental in bringing African liberation leaders to Chicago as well as a practice. Could you talk a little bit more about the importance of that Pan-African connection, the face-to-face, community-to-community, again, this is coming out of your development. You know, you grew up in this, this connective or a collective and communal environment. Talk about that as a practice, African liberation leaders coming to Chicago, that eventually leads obviously to, more work. And then, of course, I just wanted to historical note, you have IWW, you have Haymarket, you have Sleeping Car Porters. There is some history in Chicago that, again, you were a part of or your family was a part of that's important in this. Could you, you can respond in any way you want to that long diatribe.
Well, I think one of the first things I have to always acknowledge is that I came from a particular family situation that was really unusual. And that was the tremendous engagement of particularly my father and his brothers, but my mother as well, in African questions. I mean, I think I was no more than maybe 10 or 11 when my father took me to hear Kwame Nkrumah speak in Chicago, and on the one visit that he made ever to Chicago. That was a tremendously important moment for me. And to being there with all these adults and probably the only child there, it left a tremendous impression on me about Africa. And then the other thing that was happening in my family was that we always had African visitors. We always, through the Jane Addams Hull House guest organization, through later through the Experiment in International Living and a trip I made living in Sweden for a while, we always had guests from international countries, not limited to Africa. But always Africa was a big discussion item in our household. And my first engagement really with Africa began in the sixth grade when I did a book report on Cry the Beloved Country. I'm embarrassed when I look at that now. I mean, for example, I use the word I use the negative word for Africans throughout in this report, because that's the way that it had been written up by the author of the book, Cry the Beloved Country. And it was much later that I would learn what an embarrassment that was. But the visitors that we had to our house always kept us informed about what was happening and stayed in touch with us. That was a very, very important thing. So then when I finally make my first trip to Africa as a student at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and I go to study in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, I had the full support and backing of my family and of the college. It was not the first choice. I wanted to go to what was then known as Rhodesia, and I was accepted to go into the program, but then suddenly the college gets a note from the Rhodesian government that they had been informed by the FBI of the United States that I could not go to Rhodesia. And the college, this is about 2 weeks before I'm supposed to leave, it presses all these panic buttons, and they find out there's a new university starting in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And so I go with no preparation to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, to go to start a year's study there with probably some of the most amazing faculty that ever would be around. They become very famous, that faculty. Of course, the most famous is maybe Walter Rodney. I didn't get to study under Walter, but he was around and his presence was already felt by 1965. And I did get to work with incredible scholars like Irene Brown, whose husband was the Tanzanian government's attorney general. And through him, I got to meet Mwalimu Julius Nyerere. I got to be part of a demonstration that the students had against the Rhodesian government. And I'll never forget that as we were being punished, allegedly, by the government of Tanzania for what we had taken over the Rhodesian embassy, I was the only one who could drive the Rhodesian car, which we stole from the place. And I drove it, and then we were all arrested and taken up to back to the university to be, quote, punished by the president. And he came up there, and from the beginning of his talk to the end, I could see the twinkle in his eye. And as he left the gym where we were all forced to sit on the floor and listen to him, he looked at me and he said, "Are you the African-American one?" I said, "Yes." And he knelt over and he give me this big wink, and then I knew that, in fact, they were really supportive of everything we'd done. That was eye-opening for me. I was very involved later in activities at Antioch College, which was a very proactive college. So all of that fed into my becoming a force at any, including starting a chapter to get rid of any involvement with South Africa at Antioch College.
And I think one thing, if I can jump in, James, thank you. One thing I would add to Prexy's, you know, powerful remarks, you know, that really illustrate what an extraordinary childhood he had and adolescence, was the fact that he met in Chicago in his childhood Eduardo Monlan, who was the first president of the Mozambique Liberation Front, an extraordinary person who was studying at Northwestern University in a doctoral program, and got married in Prexy's family's church on the west side, a very, very important church that Prexy's family helped to integrate after they moved into the Lawndale neighborhood. That church married Eduardo Monlan because the pastor there, the minister Ed Hawley, had gone to college. They both were at Oberlin together previously, and so they were friends. And then also that church, Prexy's family's church on the west side of Chicago, became the organizing base for Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference when they did their kind of civil rights in Chicago campaign in the summer of 1966. So when Prexy got back from his junior year abroad in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, his mother, on his mother's urging, got involved in, and, you know, went to the church and got involved in helping Martin Luther King and the other members of SCLC in their fights to desegregate, in particular, Chicago real estate. But getting to know Eduardo Monlan and learning about Mozambique, learning about Frelimo, became also a very important part of Prexy's kind of life trajectory in these years.
And Martha,
I think
you're right.
Just to add to Martha's very important point, I think the other thing that really informed me in the very beginning, from the beginning onwards, was building a non-racial, anti-racism community, because Warren Avenue was a multiracial church. It was poor. It was first largely Puerto Rican, because large Puerto Rican community had moved into that part of Chicago. So it had bilingual services. And a lot of Mexicans also came to the church. And one of the things that was part of that church, including Eduardo's marriage to a white woman from Indiana, whose family was completely opposed to her marrying Eduardo. And so Eduardo's relationship to those other families, like the Nesbitt family in the church, was very important. And it was a relationship that just never ended for me. And a perspective on how and why we wage struggle.
No, that's an important point, and I want to make sure I pin this in our conversation, because I want to talk about, you know, the importance of working class perspectives in the anti-apartheid movement as well. But Martha, before we get there, you write about this, you know, this ideological development, the evolution in chapter two. You talk about, you know, some of the people. Could you talk a little bit more about chapter two and Prexy? You can obviously follow up and extend and expand, as Martha kind of opens up this particular part of the conversation. Talk a little bit more about the importance of chapter two.
Sure. Well, I think that, I think that many people, when they think of kind of like the organizing that went on in the aftermath or coinciding with the Black American Liberation Movement, you know, there was this sort of shift toward Pan-Africanism, growing attention in some ways to the world, to the U.S. role in Africa. There was a strong desire among many African Americans to build and cement closer ties with people on the continent of Africa. So there was kind of a shift for many, you know, accelerating into the 1970s. And I think that many students and scholars tend to think of, you know, we went from the civil rights movement to Black Power to Pan-Africanism, and then ultimately, you know, the anti-apartheid movement of the 1980s. And I think that what falls out of that narrative and of that ideological genealogy is an understanding of this other phenomenon known as internationalism. And this was a political outlook that Prexy very much identified with. Internationalists was a kind of international identification, but, you know, the book really tells the U.S. story. And, you know, internationalist activists were those who came out of who were very opposed to the U.S. war in Vietnam. They were very influenced by the anti-war movement. They came out of that experience really committed to trying to do their best to guard the autonomy of national liberation struggles in the global South, to develop the kinds of politics and societies that would meet their developmental needs. And, you know, they also were trying to prevent, again, U.S. military intervention, U.S. Imperial economic or military efforts to stymie those national liberation efforts coming out of the global South. This was a period, too, in the what was then termed the Third World, in which there was a kind of ascendance of socialist politics and socialist orientation. They had seen the first efforts of post-colonial nations be stymied by continuing U.S. and Western, U.S. and European efforts to sort of continue to control, particularly the economic policies and dynamics in the region. So they had been stymied in their efforts to create post-colonial, more egalitarian societies that had seen more redistribution of wealth. So that encouraged, I think, an interest in socialist experimentation. So this internationalist kind of political group that Prexy was very much a part of saw themselves as anti-imperialist, as open to this socialist aspiration coming out of the global South, in contrast to, say, Pan-Africanists who tended to identify more sort of racial feeling and solidarity and identification with their interest in building closer ties with Africans. Prexy was certainly, you know, in favor of that, but that didn't define his politics and his worldview. And as he mentioned previously, he had become exposed, I think, to a multiracial stance toward internationalist organizing that also continued to inform his work and in interesting and striking ways put him in sometimes at odds with the Black nationalist fervor that was in some ways more defining of this generation of Black American activism and engagement. And I'm sure Prexy has a lot more to say about that.
Well, I think one thing Martha touched on that I'd just like to mention, I was totally against the war in Vietnam, and was in part in the protest at Columbia in '68. I was thrown out of. I joined Columbia as a PhD student, and then was thrown out after the occupation of Hamilton Hall. I had not been involved in organizing that. I was one of maybe two or three graduate students. And I was just sitting in the library when some people told me, well, Black students have kicked the white students out of Hamilton Hall, and Black students are now occupying Hamilton Hall. Come and join us. So I did go and join them. And as no sooner I got involved in that and got thrown out of Columbia University, I also got drafted and was adamantly opposed to the war in Vietnam, and had actually tried to get the Black students' position in Hamilton Hall to not just be about Harlem and objecting to Columbia's expansion into Harlem. I wanted them to also object to Columbia's contribution to the war effort and to the killing of all these Vietnamese people that we were seeing so daily and so dramatically. And I got drafted, and Selective Service started looking for me all over Chicago and other places. My lawyer, by the way, was a man named Bob Van Lierop, who later would do the wonderful film A Luta Continua, The Struggle Continues, and he helped to get me out of the country. But I was in touch already with the Mozambique Liberation Front and wanted to join them. I wanted to fight with Frelimo. They said, no way. How is your Makua? How is your Makonde? Can you name all of the rivers up in northern Mozambique? I said, no, I don't know any of that. So they said, well, what you can do is work with us, and work with us in terms of education, which we view as a crucial part of the arm of the struggle for liberation in Mozambique. And so I was supposed to do that. However, it got thrown into all kinds of complications because of the fact that the World Council of Churches and Church World Service financed me to go and join Mozambique. very complicated process. And I then had to go and work for a brief period in Kenya. And the Kenya episode of my life is a very revealing one, but not one that I talk a lot about and is written about it very much, because I go and work in Kenya and unearth all kind of corruption in the Kenyan government and get banned, literally banned from Kenya, thrown out of the country, sent down to Dar es Salaam in the company of a whole lot of Pan-Africanist Congress combatants who had also been thrown out of Kenya. A lot of that kind of stuff happened in those days. And I get to be very involved in the politics of Kenya and Tanzania. The other thing that happened in London was that I got to be exposed to some extraordinary and pivotal people like C.L.R. James. I mean, I had time with C.L.R. James and his wife. I had time with Walter Rodney and Pat. I had time with Basil Davidson. I worked for his committee. And then I started meeting all these ANC people like Joe Slovo, and particularly, and we'll never forget meeting Albie Sachs's wife, Stephanie Sachs, who she and I become very close. She takes me to a big protest in France in support of the Vietnamese struggle. And there I get to converse with James Baldwin, just Baldwin and I, sitting and talking about this, because he was so happy to see an African-American. So my world is being expanded like crazy with all of this. But a fundamental part of it is that it's not defined by color. Lots of the people that I begin to work with are people who have values. That's what the values that they have. And they work with other people who have values to change the world. Not the color, the coloration, the values.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation with Prexy Nesbitt and Martha Biondi. The conversation explores historical continuities in contemporary issues and what solidarity really means. A lifelong organizer, Prexy Nesbitt was a key leader of U.S. solidarity work with African liberation struggles from the 1960s through the 21st century. Martha Biondi is the Lorraine H. Morton Professor of Black Studies and Professor of History at Northwestern University. The music in the background is Uhuru by Osibisa. You are listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation between Prexy Nesbitt and Martha Biondi, and African Now's executive producer and co-host Jane Spope.
And this, and out of, you know, Martha, as you write this chapter, I don't want to spend too much in it, but it was just one of the chapters that drew me the most. I've been going back and forth. It's because I'm very interested in the intellectual development that is merged with practice. But I'm also very interested in some of the schisms. I'm interested in not as a way to kind of carry on those schisms, but to kind of learn from those breaks, to learn from where those deviations kind of moved people off of their objective of African liberation, right? So if you can respond to that. I mean, that's what I'm getting from that chapter is an example in this moment that I think is super important. Again, we're seeing a number of fractures that are happening in a lot of embryonic movements that are happening, you know, globally. People are having some, subtle or kind of hidden types of ideological differences that are kind of fomenting. Could you talk a little bit more about the importance of laying that out? And what is it that you would like for people to actually, when you're reading this, is it that to learn from that mistake, to learn from being able to figure out, as Prexy is saying, how we move beyond the barriers of limited conceptualizations of our ideological tendencies, so to speak? I know that's a, there's a lot, but
yeah,
and we're all not going to solve it all here. Right.
But yeah. I mean, I'll just make a couple of points. I mean, I think that, you know, one thing that Americans certainly were very influenced by was the Cold War and the deep anti-communism that structured and shaped American culture and American politics for so long. I mean, majorities of Americans for a long time during the U.S. war in Vietnam, you know, in some ways bought what we know is now the lie, right? That the U.S. was defending freedom, was there to sort of, was motivated by a sincere kind of pledge to defend freedom against the menace of communism. And I think that, you know, as the war commenced and as the death toll commenced and as Americans learned more, they began to see that actually there was a legitimate national liberation struggle, and that the U.S. was in some ways filling in for the European colonizers and sort of defending colonialism and, you know, U.S. now under the guise of U.S. imperialism. And so that ushered in, I think, a big break. But there were still many, I think the long, afterlife of anti-communism remained strong into the 1970s and 1980s. And so there were many American activists, including Pan-Africanists, who had long been, trained to see socialism as a European-only project, as a kind of white project. We now know through long study and a greater understanding of global struggles that there's a long, you know, complicated history of African, Latin American, and Asian socialism, right? So that socialism is a living, breathing thing that people have tried to sort of tailor to their own needs and over time and place. But I think we saw this creating friction and rivalries and animosity and among different groups of Americans trying to be involved in engaging African liberation in the 1970s. So whether it was in Angola and, you know, different Americans supported different organizations, and some of this was very influenced by the Cold War and Cold War geopolitics. I think Prexy, and many in his orbit, tried to, in some ways, bring some humility and modesty and be attentive to what were the needs of people on the ground in these countries and in these fights and in these organizations. And how could Americans, instead of Americans sort of being arrogant and bringing their view of the world, how could Americans be open and responsive to what their needs were? And sometimes they said, you know, we want you to build a multiracial movement to sort of influence and shape U.S. foreign policy. So, you know, because that's what they felt was appropriate in that time and place, I think Prexy and his allies felt that that's what they had to do. So I would say a lesson, you know, from this period is to be attentive to what, you know, this is, I guess, again, the mission of internationalism and solidarity. Like, what does solidarity mean? You know, it means to being both true to your own values, right? Of course, you can never abandon your own values, but you have to be attentive to what the needs are on the ground in this society that's typically under siege and needs material support, needs political support, and so on. So, you know, this, as we see as the book goes on, this becomes more vexed when these idealistic socialist aspiring national liberation organizations assume state power and then are constrained by international forces, by military attacks, and maybe don't live up to the dreams that many of their internationalist allies, you know, had hoped for. So it can become more vexed, the whole project of internationalism and solidarity, when these groups assume state power. So that's sort of a long, kind of long rambling answer to your question, but Prexy, I'm sure, has a lot to say about this. And, you know, particularly about some of these heated political questions in the 1970s around Angola, for example.
It wasn't just Angola. I would say the other thing that Martha's contribution just now reminded me of is attending a seminar in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. It must have been in 1966, 67 or 66. I can't remember the exact date. I'd have to look it up. It was a very important occasion because coming through Dar es Salaam at that point was Che Guevara. And Che Guevara and Eduardo Mondlane together conducted a seminar in the downtown Adult Education Institute called the Patrice Lumumba Institute, a seminar about guerrilla struggles. And they were discussing the fact that Che had come with, this was the period Che was doing all this international work in Africa. The stuff happening in the Congo wasn't working out at all. And he had offered to Frelimo that the Cuban forces would join with Frelimo to fight. And the Frelimo people said, no, we don't want you fighting with us. I felt much better, incidentally, since I had offered my little humble self as a fighter, and to be see that the Cubans were rejected too, I felt much better. But the serious part of this was that theirs was a national Mozambican struggle of the Mozambican people, and they didn't want it in any way deterred or reshaped by Cuban forces coming out. Ironically, this would change entirely in the case of Angola. But at that point, here was this incredible dialogue that went on between Jay and I'm in the second row, sitting with a guy named Bill Sutherland, an African-American pacifist, good friend of Bayard Rustin. And Bill was as anti-communist a guy as you could get, despite the fact that he had done tremendous amounts of anti-war work with people like Rustin and other people. And he and I were fighting as we're listening to this seminar. But what the Mozambicans were saying was a fundamental lesson for me. And that lesson was that their definition of who the enemy was and how they would stick to that definition, that they were not fighting against white people. They were fighting against Portuguese colonialism and against the agents of colonialism, who could be Mozambican, they could be Portuguese, they could be American. And incidentally, at that very time, I just written a review of a book by a guy by the name of Gibson. I think the book is called African Liberation Movements. I would urge anybody to take a look at that, because I had the great help of one of the main ideological leaders of Frelimo, George Rebello, in writing the review of that guy, who was one of the most vicious agents of imperialism, working in the African-American community, working Europe, and talking American soldiers that had fled the Vietnam War, talking them into giving themselves up. This guy was vicious. At any rate, that occasion was a great moment for me. I'm sorry, I'm being a bit too long-winded.
That's Richard Gibson, practice referring to.
Yeah.
No, this is great. And, you know, Martha, I was going to say, you know, this idea of bringing, you know, one's ideological propensity down to the ground, that was very Almacock Cabral-ish of Prexy, right? You know, and Prexy, of course, having, met Almacock Cabral, could you talk a little bit about, you know, some of those influences, right? Because again, what Martha was actually, you know, talking about is these intellectual influences, because folk are fighting on the ground, but at the same time, there are people thinking about strategy. There are people thinking about building, you know, structures of movements and how that should be, you know, rooted in the material realities of the people that you're fighting with. So could you talk, you can respond to that if you want, or if you are, I invite you to respond to that. Let me say that. I invite you to respond.
Okay. It's very important that I got to experience and learn about this tremendous relationship between all the liberation movements in the Portuguese territories. So the people like Amilcar Cabral in Guinea-Bissau, Eduardo Mondlane in Mozambique, Agostinho Neto in Angola, the leaders of Sao Tome and Principe, all of them did tremendous work with each other. And when I was working, much later, when I would work for the Mozambique government in the United States, I would share an office with a guy by the name of José Horta, who becomes the president of Sao Tome. And the essence of my point would be that they fueled each other. They gave tremendous support to each other's struggles. And I remember a very wonderful story was when my sister substituted for me going around New York listening to Amilcar Cabral. My sister was a very striking and beautiful model. And I had asked her to hear, put down every word Cabral said. She went everywhere. And finally, Cabral says, he looks up in a living room of a woman named Jennifer Davis's house. He says, "Who is this woman sitting in front of me writing down every word that I say?" And my sister comes up and she says, "I'm Prexy's sister." "Oh, Prexy, you're here for Prexy." And by that time, they were family to me. All of these people became, and that was important part of the trust and the closeness of those struggles with each other. The struggle of the people in Guinea-Bissau, the struggle of the people in Angola, the struggle of the people in Mozambique and Sao Tome, all of these were all integrally related to one another. And then they assumed further, the further family of the people in South Africa who were fighting and depended on the solidarity they got from the people in Mozambique and in Angola. And also, those relationships carried along the Organization of African Unity and countries like Zambia and people like Kenneth Kaunda, who was not a battler. He was not a battler. But he was brought along by the whole spirit of Pan-Africanism in practice that I got to see and experience in real living moments. I think that's one of the things that much later, and I don't want to go too far apart, but in the African festival, the meeting of African organizations that took place in Dar es Salaam, the famous meeting, one of the differences was that many of the folks coming from my people, coming from the States, had never experienced that kind of living solidarity. That's one that is very costly, but it's very real, and you grow from it all the time.
If I can just add in a little bit, like I think that, Prexy and, some people call it people-to-people diplomacy, but I think Prexy's close friendships and ties with many, many Africans, ordinary people, but also leaders, over many decades, and his sort of like insistence that like they need Americans, that Americans travel to Africa. He was very committed to this kind of political practice. And, he and Bob Van Lierop, through the African Information Service, hosted Amilcar Cabral on a visit to the United States in 1972, where he came to deliver the Eduardo Mondlane lecture at Syracuse University. Prexy and Bob Van Lierop drove him down to Pennsylvania, where he got an honorary degree at Lincoln University. They also hosted him in Harlem, where I think, over 100 people met and talked to Cabral. And Cabral, in the aftermath of this, really became iconic to a lot of, African-American kind of radicals in this period and really look to him. And I think it really had a tremendous impact, right? And reshaping in some ways many African Americans' view toward contemporary African politics. So this visit by Cabral that Prexy was instrumental in sort of hosting, I think, is an example of that. Another example of that is when the very important South African trade unionist, a woman named Nomonde Ngubo, her and Prexy crisscrossed the state of Kansas.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation with Prexy Nesbitt and Martha Biondi and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. The conversation explored historical continuities and contemporary issues and what solidarity really means. A lifelong organizer, Prexy Nesbitt was a key leader of U.S. solidarity work with African liberation struggles from the 1960s through the 21st century. Martha Biondi is the Lorraine H. Morton Professor of Black Studies and Professor of History at Northwestern University. She is the author of We Are Internationalists, Prexy Nesbitt, and the Fight for African Liberation. The full conversation will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is You Don't Say by Melba Liston. And we play that commemorating her birthday, which was on January 13. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain El Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, with a particular spotlight on issues concerning Palestinians. And after that is Sophie's Parlor, the Women's Collective. We have a special announcement concerning programs on January 19, which will be Martin Luther King holiday. January 19, WPFW presents Injustice Anywhere, honoring the Pan-Africanist Martin Luther King and Haiti, the first sovereign black republic. That's on Monday, January 19, from 9 a.m. until midnight. From 9 a.m. until noon, we examine the Pan-Africanist legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. From noon until midnight, we center Haiti, her history, triumphs, trouble, and culture. Africa Now will also be presenting a special show on Haiti during that time period. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Josh Myers, Kurt Erdiston, China Kozer, and Funagunda. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And to you for joining us and for supporting our show, as well as all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Aluta Continua by Mir Makeba. Have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe.
My people, open your eyes and answer the call of the drum. Frelimo, Frelimo, Samora Mashe, Samora Mashe has come. Maputo, Maputo, home of the brave. Our nation will soon be as one. Freddie Mo, Freddie Mo. Samora Machel, Samora Machel.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. A federal judge declined today to halt federal immigration operations in Minnesota. The decision came during a hearing on Minnesota's lawsuit against the Trump administration, claiming that the mass deployment of immigration agents violates the U.S. Constitution and infringes on states' rights. Addressing the lawsuit, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison said, quote, "These poorly trained, aggressive, and armed agents of the federal state have terrorized Minnesota with widespread unlawful action." Close quote. Minnesota is asking for an injunction to halt the immigration operations. In today's hearing, U.S. District Judge Catherine Menendez called the case a frontier in constitutional law and said the court needs more time to gather information. In related news, six federal prosecutors in Minnesota have resigned, saying they would not investigate the fatal shooting of Renee Nicole Good by an ICE officer. This comes as the DOJ is pressuring to focus the investigation on her actions and those of people around her. The Trump administration continues to claim the killing was justified and has blocked Minneapolis leaders from taking part in the investigation of what happened. In other news, today the U.S. government announced a sweeping pause on immigrant visa processing for citizens of 75 countries. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
Just today, a State Department directive ordered a stop to the issuing of immigrant visas for applicants from 75 countries, beginning on January 21st. The pause affects nations from Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas, including Iran, Russia, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Brazil. Officials say that the move is intended to prevent the admission of immigrants deemed likely to rely on public assistance, the idea being that immigrants from these countries would use up American social services. Indeed, a State Department spokesperson said that immigrants from these countries would, quote, "exploit the generosity of the American people," end quote. The suspension of immigration from these countries was framed as a pause while the administration reassesses its policy. Still, the suspension does not have an end date, leaving many who want to move to the U.S. stuck in limbo. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
And in Iran, hundreds continue to die every day as protests continue and international concern intensifies. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Human rights groups now estimate that more than 2,500 protesters have been killed since demonstrations began, making this the deadliest unrest that Iran has faced in decades. Iranian security forces are accused of using live ammunition, with hospitals reporting thousands of injuries, on top of the thousands of protesters who have been jailed recently. Iran has fast-tracked trials using capital punishment, prompting condemnation from the United Nations, where Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said such actions would violate international law. One particular instance of note is Irfan Soltani, a 26-year-old protester who was arrested just last week on January 8th, but he already faces the death penalty. As the death toll mounts, the United States has begun withdrawing some troops from military bases in the Middle East, calling the move merely a precaution. European governments have echoed these concerns, summoning Iranian diplomats. The protests began over soaring inflation and food prices, but have evolved into a broader challenge of Iran's leadership, with the country's reformist president, Pezeshkian, unable to rein in more powerful religious leaders. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shairana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is the show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs